39. During the daytime you had no time to think, no opportunity to just be yourself. During the daytime comradeship brought contentment. It is indubitable that a certain kind of happiness thrives in such camps. It is the happiness of comradeship. It was a pleasure to go for a cross-country run together in the morning, and then to go naked into the communal hot showers together, to share the parcels that one or another received from home, to share also responsibility for misdemeanours that one of your comrades had committed, to help and support one another in a thousand little ways. We trusted one another without reserve in all the actions of the day, and had boyish battles and fights. We were all the same. We floated in a great comforting stream of mutual reliance and gruff familiarity. Who would deny that that brings happiness? Who would deny that men yearn for this, a yearning that is rarely satisfied in ordinary, peaceful, civilian life? I, for my part, do not wish to deny it. And yet I know for certain, and emphatically assert, that this very comradeship can become the means for the most terrible dehumanization, and that it has become just that in the hands of the Nazis. They have drowned the Germans, who thirst after it, in this alcohol, to the point of delirium tremens. They have made all Germans everywhere into comrades, and accustomed them to this narcotic from their earliest age, in the Hitler Youth, the SA, the Reichswehr, in thousands of camps and clubs, and in doing this they have driven out something irreplaceable that cannot be compensated for by any amount of happiness. Comradeship is part of war. Like alcohol, it is one of the great comforters and helpers for people who have to live under unbearable, inhuman conditions. It makes the intolerable tolerable. It helps us cope with filth, calamity, and death. It anaesthetizes us. It comforts us for the loss of all the amenities of civilization. Indeed, that loss is one of its preconditions. It receives its justification from bitter necessities and terrible sacrifices. If it is separated from these, if it is exercised only for pleasure and intoxication, for its own sake, it becomes a vice. It makes no difference that it brings a certain happiness. It corrupts and depraves men like no alcohol or opium. It makes them unfit for normal, responsible civilian life. Indeed, it is, at bottom, an instrument of decivilization. The general promiscuous comradeship to which the Nazis have seduced the Germans has debased this nation as nothing else could. Observe how centrally and fatally this poison attacks the soul. I reiterate that poisons can bring happiness, body and soul can crave for them, they can even be indispensable in their place. They are, nevertheless, poisons. To start with the essential point, comradeship completely destroys the sense of responsibility for oneself, be it in the civilian or, worse still, the religious sense. A man bedded in comradeship is relieved of all personal worries and of the rigours of the struggle for life. He has his bed in the barracks, his meals and his uniform. His daily life is prescribed from morning to night. He need not concern himself with anything. He lives not under the severe rule of each for himself, but in the generous softness of one for all and all for one. It is one of the most unpleasant falsehoods that the laws of comradeship are harder than those of ordinary civilian life. On the contrary, they are of a debilitating softness, and they are justified only for soldiers in the field, for men facing death. Only the threat of death justifies and makes this egregious dispensation from responsibility acceptable. Indeed, it is a familiar story that brave soldiers, who have been too long bedded on the soft cushions of comradeship, often find it impossible to cope with the harshness of civilian life. It is even worse that comradeship relieves men of responsibility for their actions, before themselves, before God, before their consciences. They do what all their comrades do. They have no choice. They have no time for thought, except when they unfortunately wake up at night. Their comrades are their conscience, and give absolution for everything, provided they do what everybody else does. Then the friends took the jug, and bewailed the sorrowful ways of the world, and its bitter laws, and threw the boy down. Close, foot by foot, they stood, at the edge of the chasm, and threw him down, closing their eyes, none more guilty than his neighbour, and they threw sods of earth, and flat stones, after him. That is by the German communist poet Brecht, and it is meant as praise and commendation. In this, as in so much else, the communists and the Nazis are of the same opinion. It was comradeship which in a few weeks in a camp at Jüterbog had moulded us, referendars, after all, with an intellectual academic education, future judges, into an unthinking, indifferent, irresponsible mass in which sayings like those about Paris or the Reichstag fire were commonplace, went unanswered and set the intellectual tone. Comradeship always sets the cultural tone at the lowest possible level, accessible to everyone. It cannot tolerate discussion. In the chemical solution of comradeship, discussion immediately takes on the colour of whining and grumbling. It becomes a mortal sin. Comradeship admits no thoughts, just mass feelings of the most primitive sort. These, on the other hand, are inescapable. To try and evade them is to put oneself beyond the pale. How familiar were the attitudes that governed our camp comradeship absolutely and irrevocably? They were not really the official Nazi party line, but they certainly had a Nazi character. They were the attitudes we had had as boys during the Great War, which had dominated the Rennbund, Altpreußen, and the athletics clubs in the Stresemann era. A few Nazi-specific ideas had not yet taken root. For instance, we were still not virulently anti-Semitic, but we were not prepared to make an issue of it. That was a trifle. Who could take it seriously? We had become a collective entity, and with all the intellectual cowardice and dishonesty of a collective being, we instinctively ignored or belittled anything that could disturb our collective self-satisfaction. A German Reich in microcosm. It was remarkable how comradeship actively decomposed all the elements of individuality and civilization. The most important part of individual life, which cannot be subsumed in communal life, is love. So comradeship has its special weapon against love, smut. Every evening in bed, after the last patrol round, there was the ritual reciting of lewd songs and jokes. That is a hard and fast rule of male comradeship, and nothing is more mistaken than the widely held opinion that this is a safety valve for frustrated erotic or sexual feelings. These songs and jokes do not have an erotic, arousing effect. On the contrary, they make the act of love appear as unappetizing as possible. They treat it like digestion and defecation, and make it an object of ridicule. The men who recited rude songs, and used coarse words for female body parts, were in effect denying that they had ever had tender feelings or been in love, that they had ever made themselves attractive, behaved gently, and used sweet words for these same parts. They were rough, tough, and above such civilized tenderness. Naturally, it fitted the style that civilian courtesy and manners were an easy prey to comradeship. Gone were the times when, blushing and awkward, we had bowed and displayed our good upbringing. Here the normal expression of disapproval was, "Shit!" "Well, you assholes," was a friendly form of address, and ass-kicking was a popular pastime. The need to be an adult had been dispensed with here, and replaced by an obligation to be childishly boyish. For example, it was customary to attack a neighbouring dormitory at night with water bombs, drinking mugs filled with water to be poured over the beds of the defenders. A battle would ensue with merry hoes and ha's and screaming and cheering. You were a bad comrade if you did not take part. If the night patrol appeared, everyone disappeared into their beds as quickly as possible. There we lay, snoring and pretending to sleep. It was taken for granted that comradeship prevented those who had been attacked from telling tales. They would declare to the authorities that they had seen and heard nothing, and would rather admit to having wet their beds than accuse their comrades. The next night, however, we had to be prepared for a revenge attack. This leads me to certain dark and bloody aspects of comradeship that could not be absent. If someone committed a sin against comradeship, or acted superior, or showed off, and exhibited more individuality than was permissible, a night-time court would judge and condemn him to corporal punishment. Being dragged under the water pump was the punishment for minor misdemeanors. However, when one of us was proved to have favored himself in distributing butter rations, which were still quite adequate at that time, he suffered a terrible fate. Darkly, the procedure to be used was debated in his absence. That evening there was a heavy atmosphere of anticipation in the dormitory. The evening round passed. Even the obligatory smut was recited only briefly and half-heartedly, and did not raise the usual titters. Suddenly, the fearsome, wrathful voice of the self-appointed chief judge intoned, "Meyer, we have something to say to you." Before much could be said, the unfortunate man had been dragged from his bed and spread-eagled on a table. "Every man will whack Meyer once. No one is excused," the judge thundered. From outside I heard the slapping noise of the blows. I had gotten myself excused, after all. I had claimed not to be able to stand the sight of blood, and had been graciously allowed to be the lookout. The victim seemed to accept his destiny. By the dark laws of comradeship that governed us, independently of our individual wills, a complaint would have put him in danger of his life. Somehow, the matter was allowed to be forgotten. And a few days later he was one of us again, almost as though nothing had happened. Even the rules of honour and self-respect were no match for the corrosive power of comradeship. It is clear that there is something demonic, deeply dangerous, in this widely praised, harmless male comradeship. The Nazis knew what they were doing when they made it the normal way of life for an entire nation, and the Germans, with their lack of talent for individual life and happiness, were so dreadfully ready to submit to it, so willing and eager to exchange the delicate, hard-to-reach fruits of freedom for the juicy, swelling, close-at-hand intoxication of general, undiscriminating, vulgar comradeship. It is said that the Germans are subjugated. That is only half true. They are also something else, something worse, for which there is no word. They are comraded, a dreadfully dangerous condition. They are under a spell. They live a drugged life in a dream world. They are terribly happy but terribly demeaned, so self-satisfied but so boundlessly loathsome, so proud and yet so despicable and inhuman. They think they are scaling high mountains, when in reality they are crawling through a swamp. As long as the spell lasts, there is almost no antidote.